Today, who are the oligarchs, aristocrats, and big corporations who own more than half of England? And UK technology editor Alex Hearn on the use of facial recognition software by the police.
I was 10 years old, growing up in Newbury, leafy town in the Home Counties in Berkshire, and I really loved going for walks with my parents in the countryside around to where I grew up. Huge amounts of old woodland, ancient woodland, lovely old oak trees, and suddenly there was this announcement that they were going to build a huge bypass.
Anti-road campaigners are claiming victory, having stopped the first day of work on a bypass at Newbury in Berkshire.
They arrived before dawn, 20 protesters and a makeshift wigwam.
Thousands of trees were going to be felled to build this new road, to build the great car economy, as I think at the time Margaret Thatcher and John Major's governments were calling it. And it just felt, yeah, just completely wrong.
Was the road built?
The road was built. They had to move thousands of little tiny snails to build it.
Oh.
Looking back on that, that was a really formative moment for me. I really kind of got interested in the environment and land and our landscape and how we look after it as a result of that. And I started to wonder, well, actually, who owned that land? Who actually allowed that to happen?
It was a question that Guy Shrubsall couldn't shake. And many years later, as an adult, by then with a day job at Friends of the Earth, he decided to try to answer it, almost like a hobby, in his spare time.
I started really with where I grew up. I started looking at who owned West Berkshire.
And from there, he went from county to county using creative techniques, from maps unearthed in council storerooms to lists obtained via Freedom of Information, as well as old-fashioned door knocking and even trespass, trying to solve the mystery of land ownership. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, who owns England?
The government's official body for registering who owns land is the Land Registry.
Land Registry is rich in heritage and rich in vision, looking to the future.
It's been around for 160 years, and it still hasn't finished registering all of the land in England and Wales. It had this one job that it has to do.
When did it start again?
1862.
And they've just been trying ever since then.
Yeah, still hasn't finished.
Land Registry, providing real value for money for everyone in England and Wales.
And why is it so difficult to get information from the Land Registry?
So they have registered about 83% of the land, but you have to pay £3 to look at every single land title, every single field, every single building that you want to find out who owns that. You have to pay £3 for it. So they've got 24 million land titles registered.
So how much is that?
About £72 million to buy
the lot. £72 million to find out who owns England.
Yep. And often the land, even if it has been registered, it may have been registered by a trust or an offshore company, and the ultimate owner hides behind this further level of secrecy as well.
So I'm assuming, no offence to Friends of the Earth, that they weren't paying you enough to use the Land Registry to work out who owns England, or even to work out who owns Berkshire.
Sure,
so
absolutely.
When you started in West Berkshire, what did you do?
I started by going on a trespass, actually. Trespassed around some big estates, poking around a bit.
You broke in?
No breaking, just entering. Didn't need to break in, just climbed over some walls. Big estates sort of leave their traces in the countryside. You know, you can go to some villages and it sort of starts to feel as if feudalism has never died, because you can start to see how actually the big estate, the big landowner, continues to dominate the entire area. So I went to this little village called Yattendon, and all of the houses are painted the same colour, exactly the same colour. It's Yattendon green. You get this sort of hint that actually the whole place is owned by this big shadowy estate.
That loves green.
That loves green, yeah.
And how did you find out who it was?
Under the very boring Highways Act, there's a little clause whereby estates can say, we don't want you to create new public rights of way across our land, so we're going to lodge a map of our estate with the council to protect it against these rights of way claims. But that means that those maps are then kept by the council, either in a dusty filing cabinet or on the back page of their website. It turned out that West Berkshire had actually got all these maps digitised, but just hadn't really published them properly. So I put in a Freedom of Information request to release those maps, which they gave to me, and then I could start to analyse them and look at them and see who owned the land. And it turned out that half of the entire county was owned by just 30 landowners.
Half?
Yeah.
And were any of them people who are significant, whose names we might recognise?
Well, I usually, when I tell this story to people, I usually ask them to guess who it was. And people say, oh, it must have been the Queen, or it must have been the church, or an Oxford college, or so on. But it actually turns out that it was the area's MP. It's Richard Bennion, who's the wealthiest MP in Parliament.
Introducing Richard Bennion. His blue-blooded lineage has certainly been kind. Estimated to be the House of Commons' richest MP, he's worth approximately £110 million.
He's very rich.
He owns the biggest estate in West Berkshire, yeah. It's a 12,000 acre.
Did you do anything with that information? Did you write it in the local paper?
I'd started this blog called whoownsengland.org and decided to carry on really investigating this big mystery, this big question of who owns land in this country. Lots of people started coming out of the woodwork saying, I know who owns this bit and I know who owns that bit. One of the people who got in touch with me was a very brilliant data journalist and computer programmer called Anna Powell Smith. And we worked together on a lot of the maps that we ended up producing on the website. Basically just started this sort of big kind of detective investigation, trying to uncover a long lost mystery about who owned the country.
I love this idea of you as a detective on the side because you kept the day job.
Yes.
Okay, so we're starting on our mystery. You've already mentioned a prime suspect, the Queen, or more generally, the Crown. What land do they own?
Well, I mean, originally, back in 1066, when William the Conqueror came over and became the first Norman King of England, all of the land suddenly became the king's, the monarch's, because he said, I own it. By force of arms, I'm going to declare it mine.
And has that changed?
So technically, the Crown still owns all the land in England and Wales.
So technically, the Queen owns your house and mine?
Technically, it could have been a very short book. And I could have left it and said, the Crown, and left it at that.
But I'm guessing she doesn't act on that.
Exactly. So in reality, if you own a freehold in land, it's called, even though that's technically from the Queen, from the Crown, you've basically got the right to do whatever you want with it.
Okay, so technically the Queen owns my garden. Yeah. What else does she own?
The northern edge of Norfolk, where the low light casts long shadows. And it's home to the most private of Her Majesty the Queen's rural hideaways.
She owns Sandringham.
Sandringham.
This big personal estate of hers over in Norfolk, 20,000 acres. There are these things called the duchies. So the duchies of Lancaster, which the Queen owns, or the Crown owns as the personal estate of the Queen. And what Prince Charles owns, which is the Duchy of Cornwall. These medieval anachronisms, they don't pay tax or corporation taxes. They're not subject to freedom of information requests. So they're not really subject to a lot of these things. So to find out more about them took things like looking at farm subsidy information, looking at court cases where they've had tussles with other tenants or landowners in the area. Actually, one of the best sources was an old edition of National Geographic, which my grandma had in her house, which the Duchy had obviously worked with them to produce a map, which they snuck it out into National Geographic magazine, but have never produced it elsewhere.
You just stumbled across it at your gran's house.
Yeah.
That was quite lucky.
Yeah.
Did you find out how much in total the royals actually own, as opposed to technically own?
Yes. So it was a grand total of 450,000 acres of land.
Sounds like quite a lot.
It is a lot. In the grand scheme of things, in the terms of the whole of England, it actually only amounts to about 1.4%.
Okay, so the other sort of prime suspect, if you like, was the church. Do they own a lot?
Yes, they do definitely still own a lot of land, but they own a hell of a lot less land nowadays than they once did. But actually, the church centrally don't seem to know particularly where it's gone.
Well, they've just like accidentally misplaced a load of land.
They've lost it. They've just lost it down the back of a sofa. But actually, what probably has happened is that a lot of the land that they've lost is called glebe land, which was kind of owned by local kind of vicars. And a lot of that could have been sold off by local vicars to supplement their salaries. Kind of a bit dodgy, kind of a bit like selling off the family silver.
But, so how much have they been left with?
A grand total of 175,000 acres, which is 0.5% of England.
Okay, all right. The mystery is underway, and we've so far worked out the royal family and the Crown own around 1.5%, and the church owns around 0.5%, so 2% accounted for. All right, my next question. How important is your ancestry?
Very important, it turns out. The Duke of Westminster was once asked for some advice for how to get on in life if you were a young entrepreneur living in England today. And he famously replied, have an ancestor who was a close friend of William the Conqueror.
So what, William the Conqueror just gave out land to his mates?
Absolutely. He gave it out to 200 Norman barons, of which the ancestor of the current Duke of Westminster was one of them. And he got handed out a load of land in Cheshire, hundreds of thousands of acres, in fact. And some of that land has continued to be held in the hands of the Dukes or the Grosvenor family to this very day.
But there has been this sense, I'd say, in recent decades that the aristocracy has lost its influence. I mean, you've been researching this, you've been trying to find out. Did you find that that was true?
There's this sort of big myth around the aristocracy that they've kind of this big decline and fall. But actually, the story is actually of their strange survival. They've held on to an enormous amount of land.
Do you know how much?
It's harder to pin this down compared to sort of the Crown and the Church, where some more records exist. But it looks like they still own something in the region of 30%.
30%?
Of England, yeah.
And how many people is that?
We're talking about 800 peers, maybe another 1,200 baronets.
So what kind of land do these aristocrats own?
Well, they clearly own lots of big stately homes. I guess people will be most familiar with that as the kind of symbol of the aristocracy.
So this has been home for a long time, obviously, for the whole family.
Yes, indeed. I was born and brought up here.
Yeah.
In fact, I used to roller skate up and down this corridor as a child, much to my parents' annoyance.
Yes, I can imagine. Games of hide and seek, I can picture in a big house.
Well, it's almost too big for hide and seek. One could stay lost for days in this house.
Also, sometimes things like safari parks, like Longleat.
This is lion country, right enough, but a green and pleasant land, not a desert or a national park in Kenya's dry bushland. This is England, and we're looking at the Marquess of Bath's latest idea to keep the visitors flocking to see the sights at his stately home of Longleat. So, if you keep the right side of the game wardens and the lions, you can feast your eyes. But keep in the car or you might be the feast.
Slightly odd throwback to kind of colonial era kind of ideas as well, which is something that seems to persevere with the aristocrats. But they also own things that people probably haven't heard of or think are a kind of just a complete anachronism. Things like grouse moors, huge parts of the uplands of England that are basically used for shooting grouse.
The glorious 12th. The sport really looks like being glorious too. Of course, the grouse always hope that they won't come at all, but there's no such luck for the grouse.
Do people eat them?
People do eat them for quite a lot of money in posh restaurants.
Not knowing that people eat grouse.
It's not many people who eat grouse. I've never eaten a grouse.
I've never eaten grouse. And is there anything wrong with grouse moors?
One of the ways they're managed is to burn the heather really quite intensively. It's to create a habitat that maximises the number of grouse for the sport. One of the side effects of that is that you get worse flooding as a result. So communities that live downstream of big grouse moors increasingly are getting flooded. The rain just washes off this sort of surface of the grouse moor that's been really denuded of trees and other forms of vegetation. Aristocrats like to kind of portray themselves as the rightful custodians of the land. They're stewards of the earth for all eternity. But actually, because there's so little scrutiny of them, because there's so little understanding of what they actually own, I think often they get away with a lot that they shouldn't be getting away with.
What about cities? Because presumably there's a lot of lucrative land in the cities.
Yeah, it's amazing how much actually of central London, a really prime real estate in central London, is still owned by some very large aristocratic estates.
When it comes to posh, it doesn't get much better than Park Lane. From flash hotels to fancy homes, the price tag is always monopoly money.
These houses are conservatively estimated to be worth between 10 and 15 million pounds each. Yet surprisingly, the Duke of Westminster, one of Britain's richest men, has yet to take any action to evict the squatters.
So you could walk from Sloane Square to Regent's Park without stepping off of aristocratic land. That's going through things like the Grosvenor's estates in Belgravia and Mayfair. Mayfair is a place where it now costs about £21,000 per square metre to buy a property there.
So you're starting to piece together what England looks like. How do you go about finding who else is getting in on the act?
Well, one way is to look at the owners of empty properties. So there are some records of long-term empty properties in some of central London. And I went to visit a big mansion in Mayfair, which had been empty for 14 years. And I stood outside, just sort of peering through these sort of cobwebbed windows and thinking, oh, is there any clue here as to who owns it? And suddenly there was this noise and this guy from next door marched out of the hotel, all dressed in his suit, and marched up to me and said, "Oi, what are you looking at? Are you looking to squat here or something?"
To squat?
Yeah. Yeah.
What did you say?
I said, no, I just wanted to know who owns it. And he did actually let slip that he thought it was owned by someone from Kazakhstan. It turned out that the long lease on this empty mansion actually belonged to Timur Kelyobayev,
who it says in your book is the billionaire son of the former president of Kazakhstan.
Yes. Interestingly, though, this long lease had been bought off the Duke of Westminster, who is the aristocrat who owns a huge amount of land in Mayfair, a lot of the properties in Mayfair. So it seemed to me to be sort of emblematic of the way in which new money oligarchs, city bankers and so on are kind of moving in and starting to eat away at some of the land and property that has been owned by the aristocracy.
To be clear, we're not talking about the people you've just named, but more generally, how many of these new money properties in England are held through shell companies or in tax havens?
Yeah, so Anna, who I've mentioned previously, also worked with a guy called Christian Eriksson, who was a private eye journalist. And they looked at this a few years ago. And they were actually able to get some more information out of Land Registry almost by accident. They kind of sent them FOI requests where they replied with information that they later regretted releasing about the owners of all these offshore companies that owned land and property in England. There's a huge amount of land that is now being held in tax havens, basically, obviously for reasons of both tax avoidance and for secrecy.
And how much of this is a kind of mafia-style money laundering?
Well, I mean, this is the fear, that there is a huge amount of money laundering going on, particularly in London's overheated property market. The National Crime Agency have drawn attention to how dangerous this is and how much the secrecy around land ownership in England really protects money laundering and dark money coming into the country. So I think that's something that really there's another reason for why we should be opening up some of this information and not protecting these people.
Okay, you've looked at oligarchs and billionaires, bankers and the like, and have you been able to figure out how much land they own?
Well, the best estimate I could come up with was that they own about 17% of England.
So 30% for the aristocracy, 2% for the crown and church, 17% for the oligarchs and the bankers. And my maths is brilliant, so I'm going to 49%.
There we go, nearly half.
Half the country, wow. Where did you start looking next?
Where I started next was to look at corporations. In the last 100 years, companies have started to own huge amounts of land. They own somewhere in the region of 18% of England. But we're talking about a whole range of different companies here. We're talking about everything from Tesco's land banking to build new out-of-town supermarkets, through to mining companies looking to prospect for minerals, through to quite mysterious companies like Peel Holdings, for example, who own a huge amount of land in Liverpool and Manchester.
After well over a century of rivalry, the Port of Liverpool and the Manchester Ship Canal are now owned by one company, Peel Ports, part of the little-known but surprisingly powerful Peel Group.
They've got their fingers in lots of different pies in terms of kind of controlling property and land in the area.
And why do you think we don't know much about them?
There's hundreds of different holding companies that Peel use in which to vest their companies and their land, including some that are offshore. So Companies House, you can look up the names of companies and their directors and their owners. You look up one of the holding companies for Peel Holdings, and then you discover that they're owned by another company, and you click again, and they're owned by another company, and you search again and again and again. There's this sort of sense in which they're all nested, each one inside another, like a Russian doll.
If we add corporations to our total, that's another 18% on top of 49%. We're getting to 67%. Where is the other 33%?
By my reckoning, we've got the public sector, everything that the government owns, whether that's the Ministry of Defence or the Forestry Commission or all councils, owns only about 8.5% of England. We've got conservation charities like the National Trust or the Woodland Trust and the RSPB. They only own about 2% of England. But to put the sheer amount of land owned by the aristocrats, the oligarchs, the Queen and the Church in perspective, we should look at what homeowners own. And we're often told that we live in a property-owning democracy where we've all got a stake in the country. But really, when you look at it, actually homeowners own only about 5% of the land in England.
What you've kind of shown here, this idea that so much of England is owned by a tiny group of incredibly elite people, either aristocrats or oligarchs, or owned by corporations, it feels like we could have found the same picture hundreds of years ago. I mean, it feels like we could have found this picture in 1066.
Yeah, you go back to the Doomsday Book And you look at what it says there, and the crown and the church and 200 Norman barons owned huge amounts of the country back then. The miracle of trickle-down economics is that 200 Norman barons that owned half the country back in 1066 has turned into maybe 25,000 people who own half of England today. So this huge inequality that's been inherited and passed on down through the centuries is still with us. And I think that really points to something that's quite fundamental about inequality and is one of the reasons why we're in the state we are in currently.
Right, we've got to the end of this mystery, and through quite a lot of your perseverance, we've kind of solved it. But adding everything up, I don't think we're at 100%. Where's the rest?
Well, genuinely, we just don't know. There's about 17% of land that hasn't been registered by the land registry, and it's almost impossible to find out who owns that land. So one of the things that needs to happen is the land registry to actually get on and finish the job of registering all the owners of land. Or we have to have a new doomsday book to actually find out and reveal it at last.
And why is it important that we know?
It's really vital that we find out, not just for tackling things like money laundering, but also for things like solving the housing crisis, for stopping land banking going on, for solving the ecological crisis we face. So the depletion of nature on things like grouse moors and our uplands is linked to that. And I think it's really fundamental that we get a better sense of this common shared resource that we all should be sharing, but is actually still owned by a tiny number of people.
Guy, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
A spokesperson for the Peel Group said the diversity and history of the Peel Group's portfolio of investments and our wide-ranging partnerships across both the public and private sector means our land holdings are often held in numerous companies. They say their website provides a comprehensive insight into the group's investments, including land holdings. Richard Bennion, MP, said, "The Englefield estate, like many others in Britain, is a long-established family business. Estates are very much part of the inclusive, sustainable future of rural England, running vibrant businesses and providing employment, housing, workspace, community facilities, public open space and space for nature." Guy Shrubsole has put all of his research together in a book called Who Owns England, which is out now. And go to theguardian.com to read a really interesting exclusive story earlier this week by Simon Murphy. He carried out a Guardian investigation and found that there had been scores of complaints about rented properties on royal land. The work even showed that tenants have faced more than 100 evictions. Coming up, should we be worried about the use of facial recognition software by the police? Now, UK police are facing calls to stop the use of facial recognition software after independent research has found that matches were only correct in a fifth of cases. It's also claimed that the use of this controversial technology is likely to breach human rights legislation. The Guardian's UK technology editor, Alex Hearn, explains what facial recognition is and why we are right to be concerned.
Facial recognition covers an awful lot of technologies, all of which are linked by the idea of a computer reading a face and gaining some information from it. The most common application of this tech is using it as a biometric identifier. That is essentially looking at your face and matching you to an entry in a database, typically saying who you are. It's currently used most widespread in security. So in the UK, we have had it trialed on the streets for police seeking to find people who they are trying to arrest and match them to that entry in a database. And then national security as well, where you build up a list of wanted terrorist suspects. So sort of this area, security. At the one end, there are concerns purely about the accuracy and the risk that false positives or negatives can cause real harm. Policing is a good example. If you are wrongly matched to the profile of a wanted violent criminal, you know, you may well end up being arrested and thrown in a jail cell for the hours or days it takes to prove that you're not the person they think you are. But to my mind, there is a broader and deeper problem than sheer error rates. Error rates can and will be improved. It is not less scary if we have systems that are 100% accurate at matching people based on their faces to databases you have to assume that walking down the street, you will be matched to multiple databases with no ability to opt out, with no knowledge that you are even being profiled in this way. So Liberty have called this technology arsenic in the water supply of democracy. And this is because we as society have kind of built up norms of what we expect our government and our security forces to know about us based on a world in which this technology doesn't exist. We expect, for instance, that if you do nothing wrong and don't come to the interest of the police and security forces, that in turn the police and security forces won't really know much about you. That is rapidly dying off, that assumption. We are moving instead, without thinking about it, without planning it, and without discussing what protections we need, to a world in which every police officer has instant access to a database of the movements of anyone. It isn't hard to imagine an authoritarian state or a government which just has, you know, mild authoritarian inclinations starting to use that same absolute ubiquitous database from which you cannot opt out to track dissent, to track opposition, to track people who support the wrong political party or who speak too loudly against government policies. This technology makes that so difficult to avoid that it needs to be discussed before it's put into practice, not after. A lot of American cities have already banned this technology on police body cameras for precisely these reasons. They don't want police to have access to this technology before there is a real understanding as to what it will mean for policing, for freedom and for democracy. At the other end, the increasing application of it within China. It's played a huge part in the creation of a widespread surveillance state. It has been used to keep track of jaywalkers who are spotted crossing the street when they're not allowed to. It has played a huge part in the policing of the current ongoing protests in Hong Kong, where demonstrators are near constantly masked up out of fear that even if they're not arrested on the day, they will be tracked down and arrested days, weeks, or months later when they do not have the safety of the crowd, when they do not have the safety of the international press keeping an eye on them. China is showing where this technology can take us, and that alone should really worry anyone who defends its use in Britain.
That was Alex Hearn. He writes great pieces about all of this and more. Do follow him on the website. My thanks to Guy Shrubsole and Alex Hearn. Today's episode was produced by Josh Kelly and Zoe Gelber. Sound design was by Ian Chambers. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. We'll be back on Monday.